From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Dr. Mike Stroud studies how the human body holds up when subjected to physical extremes. Last year, he studied his own frostbitten body as he and explorer Sir Ralph Fiennes made the first unassisted journey on foot across Antarctica. On today's Fresh Air, Stroud tells us how they survived the expedition. Also today, John Cale brought an avant-garde sensibility to rock and roll. We'll talk about his music before, during, and after the Velvet Underground. He has a new CD retrospective. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Hungry for Stink, the new album from L7, a rock band of women that's performing on the Lollapalooza tour. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Haiti's de facto president is responding angrily to yesterday's United Nations Security Council resolution. It clears the way for a possible U.S.-led invasion of Haiti. NPR's Michael Sullivan reports from Port-au-Prince.
Emile Jonassan, the man installed as interim president by Haiti's military leaders in May, declared in a dramatic announcement broadcast live on Haitian radio and television that the Battle of Haiti is underway, and he called on all Haitians to resist an invasion, vowing his government would fight one with all its might. Shortly after his broadcast, a state of siege was declared in a statement read by the head of Haitian television, a statement signed by Jonassan and his cabinet. There was no direct response to the UN vote from the leaders of the Haitian military, but they reportedly met with Jonassan and members of his cabinet several hours before his broadcast. The streets of Port-au-Prince were relatively quiet this morning. Under the 1987 Constitution, a state of siege allows for the suspension of many civil liberties, but for now it's unclear what a state of siege will mean for the Haitian people. I'm Michael Sullivan in Port-au-Prince.
The United Nations reports that disease may have killed at least 50,000 Rwandan refugees in the last 2 weeks. The UN's Children's Fund, or UNICEF, says the figure is based on information from French military officials who are running burials at refugee camps in Zaire. UNICEF says more than half the dead are women and children. UNICEF estimates 200,000 children have been orphaned. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees says that its office still stands by its figure of 20,000 dead. That number is based on reports by health workers. In Pensacola, Florida, a longtime abortion rights opponent sought to distance himself from last Friday's killings of Dr. John Britton and his escort outside a women's clinic. John Thielen of member station WUWF reports.
Anti-abortion activist John Burt held up a small child and a local newspaper with the headline "Deadly Replay" about last Friday's killings. But as Burt spoke, chanting women from the group Refuse and Resist called Burt a murderer.
This is what we're about. We're about life, not death. This is what we're against, killing.
The chanters promised evidence tying Burt to Paul Hill, the former minister accused in the killings. Meanwhile, federal marshals are posted outside local abortion clinics in this Gulf Coast city where three people have died in less than 18 months in violence related to the abortion issue. For National Public Radio, this is John Thielen in Pensacola.
Lisa Marie Presley, the daughter of Elvis Presley, confirms that she has married entertainer Michael Jackson. She says she got married 11 weeks ago outside the United States. News reports last month said the pair were wed in the Dominican Republic. Lisa Marie says she now wishes to be known as Mrs. Lisa Marie Presley Jackson. On Wall Street, the Dow is up 30 points at 37.93. This is NPR. In the wake of bombings in Argentina, London, and Panama, an international terrorism expert says the U.S. should be taking steps to boost its own security. NPR's Carol Ann Clark-Kelly reports.
Stephen Emerson told a House Foreign Affairs panel that the recent bombings have not simply been an attempt to derail the Middle East peace process. He views them as a sign that radical Islamic militants are stepping up their battle against the West as a whole. Emerson says Western security officials are wrong if they think the attacks can be contained to Jewish and Israeli targets.
It is only a matter of time before the anti-Western ideology driving these attacks escalates into further attacks on non-Middle East targets.
Emerson says Western countries need to coordinate their intelligence, security, and immigration procedures. Democrat Tom Lantos says he's joining with Republican Whip Newt Gingrich and calling on the president to hold a summit-level conference on ways to deal with international terrorism. I'm Carol Ann Clark-Kelly in Washington.
The government has approved tests for an experimental breast implant. 50 American women will try out an implant filled with natural fat from soybean oil. The manufacturer is LipoMatrix Incorporated. It claims the new implants are safer than silicone gel and saline implants. The firm also says doctors can see more easily through the implant during mammograms so they can detect breast cancer much earlier. The company president says the device is safe because it uses a natural fat already found in the body. The owner of Cable News Network says he's interested in buying CBS. Ted Turner says he thinks any of the three major networks might be available for the right deal. A proposed merger between CBS and home shopping network QVC recently collapsed, and Turner says a merger between his cable giant, CNN, and CBS would benefit both sides. He points to the deal that exists between ABC and ESPN, the sports cable channel. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Last year, Sir Ralph Fiennes and Mike Stroud became the first people to cross Antarctica on foot without the help of other men, animals, or machines. Fiennes and Stroud walked 1,340 miles, each man pulling a sled weighed down with nearly 500 pounds of supplies. The temperature dropped down to minus 86 degrees Fahrenheit. The men had gangrene, hypothermia, stomach disorders, and were starving. Why did these men do it? Fiennes is a celebrated explorer. My guest Mike Stroud is a doctor who studies the impact of extremes on the human body. He's a survival consultant to the British Ministry of Defense. He had served as the base doctor for a previous Antarctica expedition. In 1986, he and Fiennes attempted the first unassisted journey on foot to the North Pole. Now Stroud has written a new book about crossing Antarctica with Ralph Fiennes called Shadows on the Wasteland. Stroud told me they took remarkably little clothing on that trip across Antarctica.
We basically followed a policy that if you're working hard, which we would be pulling our sledges all the time, you get very hot very easily. So we were just wearing long underwear, a sort of fleece-type clothing, and a thin cotton outer jacket. That was all we had. It's less than perhaps many trekkers or backpackers would wear just going out in the hills in the fall, perhaps, in the States, and certainly less than they would wear in the winter. We did have good gloves and good boots and twin layers of socks and three pairs of undergloves and things like that. Hands and feet were a problem to protect, and we covered our faces completely as well because they got frostbitten very easily.
And what would you do at night? You said, you know, when you're pulling a sled, you keep warm, but at night you're not doing any work. So what would you sleep in and how would you keep warm?
Well, at night, we obviously put up a tent, and we did have very good sleeping bags. Although, surprisingly, the tent could get quite warm because, of course, the sun was up all the time, day and night, because it was the Antarctic summer. And so with the sun shining on the tent, if it was a clear night and a still night, so that the wind wasn't blowing, the tent would get warm enough. Well, it would actually get warm to hot. When it was cloudy, however, or the wind was blowing hard, then it was cold. And our bags were big, down-filled bags, specially waterproofed on the inside so they couldn't get any of the sweat from our bodies and let it get into the down and slowly degrade the down, because we had no way of washing or cleaning or repairing anything that we had with us.
Tell us a little bit about the texture of snow in Antarctica, the snow that you had to walk through and pull a sled across.
Well, people are very surprised about the snow in very cold places because it's not as slippery as you might expect. The slipperiness of snow really depends on the pressure from your ski or the sledge runner melting it a bit by the squeezing of it. And then you get a bit of water and ice together and that makes it slippery. When it gets very cold, perhaps 40, 50 below, you start finding that the snow doesn't melt at all and it becomes more like sand. And so it's more like pulling a sledge across the beach or something like that rather than across a snowfield.
So you had to work really hard to pull that sled.
Oh, yeah, it was very hard work and very continuous work for many, many hours every day.
How often did it snow?
It snowed very rarely. The Antarctic is a very dry place. It's so cold that you don't really get much precipitation. And the Antarctic is really a desert by any standards in terms of how much actually falls out of the sky. It's very, very little every year. A lot of snow blows from place to place, but it doesn't come down again.
How long do you think your footprints lasted in the snow?
Oh, not long. The Antarctic is by far the windiest place on Earth. And strong winds of 100 miles an hour blow frequently, and they blow your footprints up to dust just before, just immediately after you make them.
Now, I want you to compare for us your age and your weight and height and all of that with Ranulf Fiennes, who you traveled with.
Ran and I were very different men. He's a very big individual. He's in England, we'd say 6'4". I think perhaps you use inches in the States. He's fairly heavily built, and he was about 48 years old when we did the trip. I'm 10 years younger than that, and a small man by any standards. I'd only be 5'6". I'm a small man, whilst he's large, and I was younger. Ran was a born athlete. He really could have been an international standard athlete when he was younger, whilst I would never claim to be so fit and strong. But for the first time on this trip, he actually felt his age a bit. And whereas on past journeys we've made together, I've had a real struggle keeping up with him, on this occasion he found the trip harder than I. And he found that mentally difficult to take because it was new for him.
So he was bigger than you are, more athletically inclined, but you were younger than he is. So what kind of debates did that lead to about how to divide up the food?
We often talked about how we should divide up the sledge loads and eventually decided that we should have equal sledge loads when we started. Ran did wonder whether, being a bigger man, he should eat more than I. But there again, I felt that if he wanted to eat more, then he should actually carry more on his sledge and have a heavier sledge. So we set off with the same loads, but as the journey progressed, once we were 2 or 3 weeks into it, it was becoming evident that I was finding it a bit easier than him. And obviously we wanted to get across as fast as we could, and he eventually agreed to let me have some of the additional weight on his sledge, just a small amount to try and equalise our speeds. And for much of the journey, I took very slightly more than him, but it was pretty equal most of the time.
Who sets the pace in a trip like this? There were times when you wanted to travel faster. There were times when he travelled faster and you had a broken ankle. And it sounded like this was a cause of a lot of friction between the two of you.
Yes, inevitably, when you're travelling together, you don't always feel like moving at exactly the same speed. Sometimes when I was in front and got some distance ahead, Ran used to curse me for it and get a bit upset. But there wasn't very much I could do about it. Your body sort of dictates the speed that you want to go, and that's the speed you go. So we made some adjustments in the sledge weights to try and account for that. Later in the journey, I had a very bad ankle. I'd fallen on it. In fact, I'd fractured it. Although not too badly, but it was swollen and hurt. And then he found himself racing off ahead, and I looked at him disappearing into the distance when it was his turn leading, and got pretty upset about that as well. It hurts the morale when you get left behind, and we both had turns at getting left behind.
Did you ever lose each other?
No, we were very careful not to get so far apart that we could lose each other. And when the weather was bad, and certainly some of the time the weather would close right down with strong gale force winds and no visibility at all, really. And in those conditions, we stuck incredibly close together because if one of us had lost the other, it could have been fatal.
What were the worst medical problems you experienced during the journey?
Well, the medical problems were pretty varied, really. In some ways, the worst were just the sort of chronic ones that went on and on, the soreness that you got from the rubbing of the harness that you pulled the sledge with and the pain in your back from pulling the sledge. But we had some real acute ones as well. Ran had a terrible frostbitten foot quite early in the trip that didn't get any better and caused him terrible pain. And later he got other toes frostbitten and he had problems there. I had frostbitten fingers, which were pretty uncomfortable and made doing anything with your hands very, very painful. And I also fractured my ankle, as I mentioned.
Now, you had frostbite on your fingers, and the frostbite was so bad it took the skin off your fingers?
Yes, that's right. First, your fingers go black and swollen with blisters. And then, if it's not so deep that the whole finger is dying, which in my case it wasn't, all the dead parts of the skin all peel off like gloves coming off, and they leave a raw and terribly, terribly tender finger inside. And I ended up with 9 out of 10 of my fingers like this, sort of pink like raw meat. And they were exquisitely painful when you touch things. It was really nasty.
So that must have been fairly crippling. I mean, you need your fingers to do things.
Yes, although you don't need your fingers that much during the day in a place like Antarctica, where you just trudge along for a lot of the time. But it was awful in the tent in the evening, trying to cook, trying to dress and undress. That sort of thing was very difficult. It's amazing how hard you have to pull on a pair of socks. You don't realise it until when your fingers are hurting, you try and pull on pairs of socks and that sort of thing, getting boots on and off cooking.
Mike Stroud is my guest. His new book about crossing Antarctica is called Shadows on the Wasteland. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest Mike Stroud is a doctor and survival consultant. Last year, he crossed Antarctica on foot. Now, you conducted medical tests on both you and Rand Fines, who you were traveling with. What kind of tests did you do, and what was the purpose of the tests?
Well, the medical tests we were doing were looking at what extremes would happen to us, and they were also looking at how exercise would affect our body weight and our body composition and things like that. So we weighed ourselves before and during the trip. We measured how much fat and how much muscle we had. We took blood tests every 10 days to see what was happening to our cholesterol and other fats in the blood and the sugar levels in the blood and this sort of thing. And we measured our metabolism. That's how quickly your body ticks over and burns fuel before and after the trip. It was interesting from the point of view of survival and knowledge about what extremes you could go to, but also interesting from the point of view of what it taught us about the normal. For example, we would be losing weight through exercising a great deal whilst eating a great deal. We were actually eating twice as much as a normal person might eat. And so the way that we lost weight would be an interesting comparison to the way that people try and lose weight through dieting when they feel that they're overweight, because the influence of how much you restrict your food and how much exercise you do is not fully understood. And so we could provide some information about that.
So what did you learn?
Well, what we learned was that, for a start, exercise alone can definitely make you lose weight. I mean, we lost about 50, 60 pounds in weight through exercise alone whilst eating twice as much as normal. And with that weight loss, instead of our metabolism getting depressed, going lower, which is what happens if you lose weight through dieting, and it's one of the reasons why dieting to lose weight, you pretty soon stop losing weight, and when you stop going on the diet, you put it all back on again. With the exercise, we found that we'd lost a lot of weight and our metabolism had actually gone up. This is the way our bodies were ticking over, even at rest, sitting still. So it sort of confirmed some of the ideas about exercise and losing weight, and it confirmed them in a very spectacular way.
Now, the blood and urine samples that you took, did you have to carry those with you for the whole trip?
Yes, we collected blood and urine samples during the journey. We took blood every 10 days and small urine samples every night. And, of course, we could just let them freeze by just putting them on the sledge and they'd be frozen and preserved for when we got back. So we got some interesting changes In particular, perhaps, the fact that our blood fats, our cholesterol levels, didn't go up despite our eating four times as much saturated fat as anyone would recommend for health. We were eating a very high-fat diet because it didn't weigh so much if we took our food in the form of fat. And it didn't upset our cholesterol levels. In fact, the good sort of cholesterol went up and the bad sort went down, sort of again confirming that exercise can offset a pretty nasty diet, well, in fact, a very nasty diet. And we found that when we did measurements of our energy expenditure and that sort of thing on the urine, that we got fantastically high levels that had never been recorded. It was some interesting findings. At times we had levels of work which were twice as high, for example, as the cycle riders in the Tour de France, which is meant to be one of the biggest endurance events in the world. We got tremendously high levels of work every day because we did so many hours every day.
What were you eating?
We ate a diet that consisted of porridge in the morning, which had butter melted into it, because the butter added fat and the fat added a lot of calories. We stopped a couple of times in the day for soup, which we melted butter into as well. And when we got to the tent, we got inside and had a cup of tea and what's called a flapjack biscuit, a very fatty biscuit with some butter on it as well, and then a freeze-dried meal with some butter in it and a hot chocolate drink with some butter in it. So all in all, we ate an awful lot of butter and a very high-fat diet.
Now, you lost a lot of protein and weight in your muscles, right?
Yes, we did. Our weight losses weren't just fat. Chiefly because we burned up nearly all the fat that was in our bodies. And so we were turning to our muscles as well to burn those up. And about half of the weight we lost was muscle burnt up as well. And in fact, we took pieces of muscle before and after the trip by using a sort of enormous needle into the muscle of our thigh. And those were looked at under the microscope. And when we got back, the muscles weren't only smaller, but the enzymes in the muscles, which are the things that make them work, had gone right down. In fact, their activity had gone down by 70% in the samples we took.
This is something else about your health during this trip. When you got back to England afterwards, you were having eye problems. You were having trouble focusing on things, I think.
Yes, that's right. When we got back to civilization as such, we found that we couldn't see very well and couldn't really focus beyond things which were just perhaps an arm's length away. And we didn't know what that was, and we were examined by a specialist, and it was found that our eyes had gone, had lost the ability to focus out beyond a short distance because we'd spent so much time looking at nothing. It's actually a problem that had been recognised in the past in airline pilots and problems of near misses in aircraft, because a pilot looking out through the windscreen at nothing will slowly come into focus. So his eyes are actually in focus just in front of his face. And then he won't see the other aircraft approaching. We'd been looking at nothing for so long that we'd got used to this position and we'd lost the strength required in the muscles to focus the lens of our eyes and see further.
When you say looking at nothing, do you mean you're looking at this vast sameness of snow and horizon?
Yes, that's right. For much of the day, you spent your time looking at white, and it was featureless. And so your eyes got used to seeing nothing and didn't get used to focusing and moving around and changing the focus of your eyes, so we lost the ability to do so properly.
Now, how long did it take for your fingers, which were frostbitten, to heal?
My fingers took about 2 months, 3 months, something like that, to heal up completely. But they did get effectively completely better, although they will continue to be vulnerable to the cold in the future. Rand's toes weren't so lucky. He's lost a couple of toes from his frostbite, which was really quite bad. And his foot and other areas of frostbite did take more like 8 or 9 months to heal up.
One of your purposes in your expedition across Antarctica was to study the physical effects on the body. I'm interested also in the psychological impact of spending several months just walking across this vast snowy plain. I mean, what does that do to your mind? I know you had company, you were traveling with somebody, but you weren't always getting along because the pressures on you were so great. So did what kind of mood swings did you go through?
I found that I had terrible mood swings. A lot of the time it was just terribly difficult to keep going. And of course, although I'd done this sort of thing before, you tend after these sorts of trips to remember the good times and not really remember what it was like. Until the very first day of a new trip, like when we set off across Antarctica, you suddenly realise how awful it's going to be just mentally to keep going. And that makes it hard. Nevertheless, at the beginning of the trip, for the first month or so, we seemed to be making reasonable progress. And I spent a lot of time thinking about home and all the things I'd do when I got back and being pretty positive about life. And so things passed fairly easily in daydreams a lot of the time. But then you felt that you'd really thought every thought you possibly could have several times. And in the second month of the expedition, I began to get completely obsessed almost about whether or not we could get this journey done, and it seemed less and less likely that we could complete it. And I felt more and more negative and spent most of the time actually thinking about how I could get out of it, thinking of ways I could perhaps feign an illness to get out of it and that sort of thing. So I would spend my whole day imagining what illness I would pretend to have in order that I'd have to be evacuated. But at the same time, you know that if you do give up, that you've got to live with that, and you've committed yourself to trying this, and you know you'll feel bad about it afterwards, so you press on. In the last part of the expedition, perhaps the third month and beyond, a lot of the time you weren't thinking very clearly. You were back into a sort of daydream, but it was because we were getting pretty ill with it.
Now, when did you decide, okay, the journey's over, we set out what we accomplished, we can go home now?
Well, at the very end of the journey, we wanted to cross the last ice shelf. What Antarctica has is on its edges great big sheets of floating glacier, which are on the sea. They're not actually part of the continent, but they're sort of traditionally part of the challenge. And what we'd done was set out from the Atlantic coast of one ice shelf, cross the ice shelf, cross the continent, and come down onto the ice shelf that would lead to the open Pacific. And we wanted to cross that too. But we were only about 60, 70 miles into that when we realised things were getting so bad that we weren't going to be able to complete the last couple of hundred miles of our journey. I mean, we had gone 1,400 miles, the longest ever, but we were going to run out of food before we could complete that last ice shelf. And if we didn't, we were going to take such risks with our lives that it was beginning to be unreasonable.
So what do you do when it's time to go back? You have a satellite phone?
Well, we carried a radio, and we could get through to our base, which was now on the far side of the Antarctic, where we'd left from. And once we decided that we were going to give up, then an aircraft came out, our own aircraft that we'd chartered to pick us up. And the plane came quite quickly, actually, which was nice because we were always aware that we were asking a small plane to come and get us across a very large continent, and it might take several weeks before it could actually fly, depending on the weather. But in fact, it came quite promptly, and the journey was over.
Would you do an expedition like this again? Do you think there's another one in your future?
I said to myself on this expedition, I said it every day, I must remember this. I must never, ever do anything like it again. In fact, I even wrote it in my diary to be sure that I couldn't forget. But although I know I said that, I can't remember what it felt like to believe that. And I got a lot of satisfaction from this trip, and I would very much like to do another polar trip again. And I hope that I will do another big trip before I'm too old for it.
Well, Mike Stroud, I'm glad you returned home safely. I thank you very much for talking with us about your journey.
Thank you.
Mike Stroud's new book is called Shadows on the Wasteland. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. 934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The Velvet Underground didn't last long and didn't sell many records in its time, but it became one of the most influential bands in rock history. Coming up, we talk with co-founder John Cale about coming from the classical avant-garde and teaming up with Lou Reed. Cale has a new CD retrospective of songs from his subsequent solo career. L7 is one of the bands on this summer's Lollapalooza tour. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews their new album, Hungry for Stink. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Defense Secretary William Perry says the U.S. military troop strength in Rwanda will be smaller than planned. Perry says the number of troops will probably only reach about 3,000 instead of 4,000. He stresses the U.S. troops will not join U.N. peacekeepers who will arrive in Rwanda in about 2 weeks. Perry just got back from Rwanda over the weekend. He says what he saw was truly devastating, but he says the U.S. relief effort is helping to improve the situation there. The Bosnian Serbs now say they want to negotiate with international mediators about a peace plan they've already rejected twice. NPR's Andy Bowers reports.
2 days after the U.S., Russia, and three European partners agreed to step up sanctions on the Serbs, the Bosnian Serb leadership has announced that it wants to reopen discussions on dividing the country. The announcement added that once the map of a divided Bosnia was changed, the Serb side would be prepared to accept the peace plan drawn up by the international group. The move follows an open warning to the Bosnian Serbs by their main sponsor, President Slobodan Milosevic of Serbia, that the time has come to end the Bosnian War. Russia has also been pressuring the Serb side to accept the plan. In Sarajevo today, Serb and Muslim representatives met at the airport to discuss the recent increase in tension in the Bosnian capital. Several residents have been killed or wounded by renewed sniper fire over the last few days. I'm Andy Bowers in London.
Poles are marking the 50th anniversary today of the Warsaw Uprising against the Nazis. More than 200,000 Poles died in the revolt. Foreign guests include a Russian envoy and the German president, but this is angering many war survivors. The BBC's Julian Borger reports.
50 years ago, Warsaw was left to its destruction. The Poles don't want it to happen again, and they want the memory of the uprising to underline the country's moral claim to security guarantees from the West and membership of NATO. The Warsaw Uprising is remembered here as an expression of Polish courage and unity, but the anniversary has been more divisive. Some veterans are angry about President Lech Wałęsa's decision to invite German and Russian leaders. They remember the brutality with which two German SS divisions crushed the rising. They also remember that the Soviet army failed to intervene to help Polish resistance fighters, although it was only a few miles away. A crowd of veterans are threatening to boycott the official ceremonies as a protest against the presence of the Russian and German delegations. But most of the survivors of the uprising say they will attend.
Julian Borger reporting. The government says Americans' average income rose 0.1% in June. The Commerce Department says spending rose at the same time by 0.4%. On Wall Street, stocks moved up. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained more than 33 points to end at 3,798. Advancing issues led decliners by nearly 2-1 in heavy trading. This is NPR. The Treasury Department's handling of the Whitewater affair is drawing criticism. The Senate Banking Committee is holding another day of hearings into the matter. A former vice president of the Resolution Trust Corporation told the senators information about a pending investigation should have been kept confidential. But William Rollet says last September he told Treasury officials about the probe involving a failed Arkansas savings and loan, and he asked them not to talk about it. Rollet says one official told the White House about it 3 days later, but other RTC officials say no one in the White House tried to influence the investigation. A new United Nations study finds workers in developed nations are steadily losing privacy in the workplace. The review finds Americans are among the most closely monitored. Linda Fasulo reports.
The International Labor Organization, the ILO, examined workplace conditions in 19 industrialized nations, and the results show that U.S. workers are among those facing the greatest loss of privacy from the use of computers, cameras, telephones, listening devices, and other instruments to monitor employee behavior. One U.S. survey suggests that as many as 80% of employees in banking, insurance, and telecommunications are subject to telephone or computer-based monitoring. Yet the ILO study notes that few clear policies have been established governing usage. Another survey estimates that 20 million Americans may be subject to electronic monitoring alone. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Fasulo reporting.
There's word of a tentative transit agreement to settle the bus mechanic strike in Los Angeles. The L.A. Metropolitan Transportation Authority says it won't announce the details until the union votes on the deal. The union says the strike will go on until the agreement is ratified. The walkout has entered a second week. The transit system is operating 36 lines instead of the usual 200. Some 4,000 bus drivers and 600 clerks have honored the mechanics' picket lines. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Welsh songwriter, singer, and musician John Cale moved from the world of the classical avant-garde to rock. In 1965, he teamed up with Lou Reed to co-found one of the most influential bands in rock history, the Velvet Underground. Lou Reed wrote and sang most of the band's songs. Cale played viola and piano. The group had a dark, streetwise vision that bands today still emulate. Cale left the Velvets in 1968 and since then has been writing and singing his own songs. A new CD retrospective called Seducing Down the Door collects many of Cale's post-Velvets recordings. Cale reunited with Reed in the late 80s to write and perform a series of songs about Andy Warhol called Songs for Drella. This song, Faces and Names, is from that collaboration and is featured on Cale's new CD.
Faces and names, I wish they'd go away. I'd disappear into that wall and never talk. Talk, not talk. I wish I was a robot or a machine without a feeling or a thought. People who want to meet the name I have are always disappointed in me.
You were born in 1942. Did the beginning of rock and roll have an impact on you?
Yeah, well, a lot of it was via the radio. Mm-hmm. And I used to listen to Willis Conover and Voice of America and Alan Freed on Radio Luxembourg. So Alan Freed was the one that really, everything sort of burst wide open when you had, in England it was skiffle, but when Elvis and Jerry Lee Lewis happened. I mean, it was all over the radio there.
Did you ever imagine yourself playing music like that?
No, not at all. It was far away. But then, you know, it was a kind of a neglected side. It wasn't something I found easy to do, was to start a band there. I tried to start a jazz band, but didn't get very far. And that sort of lay dormant for all the years I was in college in London.
Your father was a coal miner. Did you ever think that's what you'd end up doing?
Well, that was one of the things that they made very sure that I never got involved with. I mean, they thought it was important for me to go down and experience what it was like to be in the mines, but they really thought that being a doctor and a lawyer was the way to go.
But not being a musician?
Certainly not being a musician, no.
Did that not seem like good, honest, hard work?
that's a funny question. It was the kind of thing that no matter how hard you worked at it, it wasn't something that was going to bring in the bread and butter. And I think it was unrealistic. And art had a role if it meant performing other people's music, but to really come up with your own, then that was really asking for it.
So now you got out of Wales by getting a scholarship to study at Tanglewood in New England?
Yeah, I went to college in London for 3 years, and then from there applied to a number of different places to continue. And I met Aaron Copland in London while he was traveling through. And I'd written a number of pieces by that time and was studying composition with Humphrey Searle. And wanted really to hook up with John Cage and work with him. And so I kind of was adamant about going to New York, whether or not I got the scholarship. But it was certainly a big help.
What was your experience at Tanglewood like?
The pieces I was interested in having performed to the people that were running Tanglewood were too violent. I mean, they carried a lot of violence with them.
What do you mean the pieces you were interested in were too violent?
Well, there were some pieces that eventually, when I did perform it there, had Mrs. Kosovitsky running out of the room in tears. But the students were prepared for it. I mean, they came with eggs and let me have it. So it was a different approach to composition, and it was more in the performance art side of things rather than in the studious written manuscript form.
Give me a sense of what you were doing on stage when they were throwing the eggs at you. What were you
playing? Well, they waited until I'd finished, but I had an axe on a table on stage, and in the middle of the piece that involved prepared piano, I picked up the axe and sort of split the table. And in the middle of an ostensibly straightforward piece of prepared piano, it's not the thing that they expected. I mean, they expected something to happen, not quite something as horrifying as they saw.
Why were you doing that?
It was, well, I mean, there were various ways in which you can cut the piano up and really to get the noise of splintering wood and creaking, breaking wood, like an old galleon that would be breaking up at sea. I mean, you had to work at it a little bit. It wasn't just sheer pummeling.
So you were doing this for the sonic effect?
Partly.
And the other part?
The other part was shock value.
Mm-hmm. And what did you enjoy out of the shock value?
I was expecting to be able to gain a little more time to find my feet and find a direction for myself musically.
My guest is John Cale. His new CD retrospective is called Seducing Down the Door. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is John Cale. He co-founded the Velvet Underground with Lou Reed. When you started playing in the Velvets, how did you find a place for the viola? I mean, this was not a common instrument in rock bands by any means.
Well, from a theoretical point of view, it was really just to create space and make something orchestral. Because we all loved Phil Spector and thought that with the four pieces and the viola doing just the fifths, and the change is that you could create a big space, you know, with just four pieces. And that was the ideal, was to do something big and orchestral like Phil Spector did.
Of course, what you were doing was completely unlike what Phil Spector did.
Yeah, I mean,
so you're doing this really kind of avant-garde drone in a lot of the pieces.
Yeah, but it's still, I think it still achieved the space. It wasn't the kind of Wagnerian space that Phil Spector was doing. And he combined R&B rhythms with that Wagnerian style. And we were kind of more, I think Lou was more into the Chuck Berry side of the guitar than into the the R&B side of it. So it was a little more rockabilly, for want of a... That's the wrong phrase to really apply to. I don't know what style you'd call it, what Sterling and Lou were really doing, but whatever came out of it was certainly different, and that was enough for us.
I want to play Heroin, and I'd like you to talk about what you're doing toward the end of this recording and how you decided what you were going to do.
Well, when the last verse came about, the whole thing was supposed to fall apart. And there would be this driving drum pattern. And I would turn and feed back the viola or take the pickup off and twirl it around like a nightstick. And the feedback would really get out of control, and sometimes you just have just sheer noise coming out of it. And then it would end, and it would end quietly. And it was meant to build to that climax anyway.
Let's hear it. This is John Cale with the Velvet Underground.
Heroin, it's my wife and it's my life. Because a maniac to my vein leads to a sinner in my head, and then I'm better off than dead. Because when the smack begins to flow, I really don't care anymore about all the Jim Jims in this town, and all the politicians making busy sounds, and everybody putting everybody else down, and all the dead bodies piled up in mounds.
When the Velvets were doing songs like this, did you relate to this street life and to the strung-out songs? To songs about drugs?
Yeah, I was intrigued by the street sensibility there. And I learned a lot from it, because I hung out with Lou for a while, and he showed me a lot of different sides of New York street life. But at the same time, one of the things that we got through very early on was this argument about the definition of what is risky, both in literature and in everyday things. And it seemed like we would push each other in that way. But there was a lot of engagement going on the literary side of things, that we would discuss and really be enthralled by a lot of different writers and keep reassuring ourselves that we really understood what the priorities were. And that was a very important part of it that went on early and sustained itself for a long time, for about 3-4 years.
I know when you were playing with Lou Reed in the Velvet Underground that there was... some friction between the two of you. Could you explain something about what the friction had to do with in terms of the music and the both of you as personalities?
Well, it was basically that there were the band was spending a lot of time on the road, and in contrast to the way the Banana album was recorded, there was very little time spent in thinking and working on the arrangements. We'd become a road band, and we would go on stage, and we'd put the backbeat behind everything that we did, and that would be it. The Banana album, on the other hand, was the product of a year and a half of fairly sedentary and boring rehearsals, which is kind of what gave us time to come up with the different arrangements that were there, and that was interesting to me. At the same time, in the general context of touring and having publicity and having a record out, we would find people that had opened for us years before suddenly soaring up the charts, and we would be in pretty much the same spot. And this was a source of great debate, which got more and more heated about which direction the band should go in, whether it should go for the pretty songs or whether we should go for the orchestral and the harder ones.
Which side were you on?
Well, I thought there was a way of covering both, but the only way to have done that would have been to stop and calm down a lot and focus a lot more. But I think at that point, if it didn't happen in a split second, it wasn't going to happen. That is, people's attention span was very short. And at the time, it just got to the point where there was no discussion anymore. And also, there's a question of management that entered into it that really thought that this was no longer a band, that there was just one artist here. And that sort of hurried things along mightily.
It seems to me that when you went on your own, you had at least two really different sides of yourself musically. One side was a more pop side, and one side was a more avant-garde and also angry, emotional side. Is that fair?
Yeah, it's... pop side really is something I can't relate to. I think there was... I liked a melody, but whenever that pop side surfaced, it was never something that seemed to stay around for very long.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the more thoughtful songs were really better, I mean, in the end, in that they probably included more of my personality than just the melodic side.
John Cale, his new CD retrospective is called Seducing Down the Door. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what do you have on Haiti on All Things Considered?
We'll be hearing from our reporters in Washington, D.C., and also in Haiti, about what people make of the latest move by the United Nations to give support to a possible military intervention there. Also on today's program, we'll hear from Senate Minority Leader Robert Dole of Kansas about his thoughts on health care reform. And we'll hear from reporter Patricia Naiman about commercial HMOs and whether high salaries being paid to the executives of those outfits might be causing increased health care costs. Also on today's program, we'll be hearing about the death of Colin Turnbull, the anthropologist.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. One of the many bands on this year's Lollapalooza tour of alternative rock and hip-hop is L7, a quartet of women based in Los Angeles. L7 has just released its first rock album for a major label. It's called Hungry for Stink. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review. I'm good.
L7 are the most likable angry people I can imagine. Hungry for Stink is a nonstop recitation of pain, rage, resentment, and bitterness. But these sentiments are presented with such furious energy and underlying joy and making such a lot of noise that the overall effect of the music is exhilarating. Although they're based in Los Angeles, L7's musical influences seem scavenged from everywhere except L.A. The buzzing guitars of Danita Sparks and Susie Gardner recall that feedbacky drone of the Ramones. As a lead singer, Danita Sparks has a shredded voice that's equal parts Joan Jett and Johnny Rotten. What L7 shares with all these acts is a gift for concision, for emotions compressed to their essence, stated in few words, played with few chords. That's a song called Can I Run, and once you dig below the blare, you realize that it's one of the scariest songs ever written about violence against women. It deals with the emotional aftermath of a rape in which the narrator closes herself up to the world, peering out of sunglasses in fear of every man she encounters. The members of L7 have said in interviews that they don't want to be identified as feminist rockers or riot girls, that they're against what they call creating genre out of gender. But there's no doubt that part of the thrill of L7's music is in the display of power that these women can summon up.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed L7's new album, Hungry for Stink. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our intern is Abby Beshkin. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Al Capone. A new biography challenges a lot of assumptions about the notorious gangster. Also, we meet Nick Cave, one of the performers on the Lollapalooza tour of alternative rock and hip-hop. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.